Several of you have commented about the sermon title today, Pharaoh's Fillies, and I cannot take credit for that. This is actually an allusion to Song of Solomon, where Shunammite is referred to by Solomon as a filly among Pharaoh's stallions, and I thought it was appropriate for this passage. We are in Genesis chapter 12, and last week we looked at the initial part of it. There were two commands that God gave to Abraham. What was the first one?
Go.
Go. Good job. What was the second one?
Be a blessing.
Be a blessing. Now, I'm bringing that up because I really didn't spend a lot of time on that. And the reason I didn't spend a lot of time on that was because I wanted to establish that as far as Scripture is concerned, we have Abraham who is ungodly. He's an unjustified follower of the Lord, and God is blessing him for that. So we want to pick our narrative up, and there's a map back there if you need a map, if you like that sort of thing, and another handout that we'll use over some period of time. But we're picking this up in the last part of verse 4. Chapter 12, verse 4. And Abram was a son of 75 years when he went out from Haran. So what we have in this section in verses 4 through 7 is the second appearance of Christ to Abram. Now, I believe these are all pre-incarnate appearances of Christ. We have a tendency to spiritualize a lot of the Old Testament and think that people are hearing voices and they're imagining things. And I think we would do a better understanding of the Old Testament to conclude with what Thomas concluded when he said of Christ after the resurrection, "My Lord and my God." He took the two titles from the Old Testament, Elohim and Yahweh, Yahweh and Elohim, "My Lord and my God," and attributed those to Jesus. And so throughout the Old Testament, you have those two terms used to refer to God, and I think we would do a better job of understanding the Old Testament if we'd interpret that as being pre-incarnate appearances of Christ. Now, sometimes this text will tell you that it's the voice of the Lord said to me and so forth, but a lot of times these are pre-incarnate appearances of Christ. And you'll also find the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament referring to Jesus. That's a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. And you have really strange passages. This is free. You don't have to pay for this. Strange passages like in Judges chapter 2. Now the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal and called, you know, he was in a different place and he went to Gilgal and he gathered Israel together. Traveling, walking. We looked at some of those things with Enoch and so forth and Noah who walked with the Lord. So Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. This is after his father had died, Terah. And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, the son of his brother, all their possessions, which they had amassed. So while they're in Haran, we don't know how long he was there. And we don't know when Christ appeared to him the first time. Presumably, it was when he was a young man. And he began to preach and communicate that message. And people believed what Abram told them. And when they believed that message, they were declared righteous, which is why the genealogy of the Toldot is traced back to Terah. But while they're in Haran, they amassed all sorts of things, people or souls, literally, whom they had acquired in Haran. So while they're there, God continues to add to their possessions. And then they went out to travel to the land of Canaan. We knew that from chapter 11. They would set out towards the land of Canaan. Presumably, the land to which God would show them included going the direction of Canaan. And now that they're at Haran, and you can see that on your uninspired map here. And by the way, the map isn't right. You won't find a correct map. And the reason for that is we don't know what the Jordan River Valley was like prior to Genesis 19. And this shows the Dead Sea and, you know, the root of the four kings against five next chapter. No, that's chapter, 13. So we don't know what this was actually like. We know it was like the Garden of Eden. We'll see that next hour. But, you know, we do the best we can with what we're trying to figure out from the text. So they amassed, and you can see where Haran is. It's way up there on the northern border of Syria and the southern border of Turkey. And they went out to travel to the land of Canaan, and they entered the land of Canaan. And Abram crossed over into the land. So this actually, you'll see in this footprint, Haran is the northernmost border of the land that God is going to give to Abraham. And he goes all the way down into Egypt. This is the footprint of what Israel will be in the kingdom. You'll see these references as we go along. And Abram crossed over into the land as far as the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Amorah. And the Canaanites were then at that time in the land. So he has moved out of the descendants of Shem. He's left the people group, although descendants of Ham, Nimrod, for instance, went up into the region of Shem and planted a number of cities, including Babylon and Nineveh. But most of the people blocks now in this area where Abram is living are not from his lineage. He has moved into a different region. And so the inclusion here of this statement, and the Canaanites were in the land at that time, is important for Israel as they come out of Egypt, because there had been a long, long period of time that God gave opportunity to the people of the land to repent of their evil, of their sin. All right, next verse, in verse 7 here. And he went to the Canaanites in verse 7. And the Lord became visible to Abram. And he said, to your seed or your dependent, singular, I will give this land. And there he built an altar to the Lord, that is, to the one having become visible to him. So this would be the second appearance of Christ, and he's now in the land of Canaan. He goes to a region, Shechem. You can see it on your map. It's not as far south in Israel as he's going to go. He continues to go south, but we would put Shechem now in the land in Samaria, mountainous region. And then in verses 8 and 9, he continues to travel south. So after he builds this altar and God appears to him and says, I'm going to give you this land, now he's going to move along. Verse 8, and he moved along from there to the mountain on the east of Bethel. So again, in the map, he's going further south, moving along south. And there's the mountain that was associated with Bethel. It's on the east, and he pitched his tent at Bethel on the west side, or literally on the seaside, and the city of Ai on the east. Now, Ai is the city that Israel fought right after Jericho and lost because of the sin of Achan. A number of men were killed there. And he built there an altar to the Lord, and he called upon the name of the Lord. So calling on the name of the Lord, lots of people have different ideas about what this means. My understanding of it is that it's not only worship, it's also preaching, that he is communicating to the people of the land. So he's introducing to them or reminding them of the original worship that was established by Christ after Adam sinned and the sacrificial system. So he's taking them to the creator of the universe and telling them that the creator of the universe wants to be worshipped this way, and that he has appeared to me personally and promised that through me the whole world is going to be blessed. Therefore, you should come and be a part of my tribe. You should join yourself to me. That's calling on the name of the Lord. And people believed the message and they attached themselves to Abraham. And he's continuing to go here in verse 9. And Abram set out traveling, and he set out headed towards the desert, the Negev. The Negev is the southernmost part of Israel. Now, you know, we'll see specific instructions later about how he's supposed to walk the whole breadth of the land that God's going to give to him. But some of this has to do with moving from the northernmost part and continuing on through the entire region. I remember when my dad would buy a piece of property, sometimes we'd go as a family to see what he had bought. And I remember as a child, he would march it off. He'd get out of the, we had a 49 Plymouth. It's a fun car, bench seat. You could actually stand up and drive the car, and Mom and Dad would trade places while they were driving to Canada. And my spot was on the train case, a little makeup case that sat between them, and I got to run the map. That's how I learned to read a map. But he would march off. His footstep, if he stretched a little bit, was 1 yard, and he'd count the measurements. When we got Grace Acres in Oklahoma, that seemed to be the right thing to do, so we marched through the land, which was helpful, because when the tax assessor came and said, there's a barn on your property, I said, oh, that's great news. Where is it? Because I've been all through the land and I haven't been able to find a barn. I found a tire dump, but no barn. So you march through the land. And I think that's what he's doing here. So he's traveling south. Now in verses 10 through 20, he's going to go on down into the land of Egypt. There was a famine in the land, and Abraham descended to Egypt to live there as an alien, as a sojourner, temporary, because the famine was severe in the land. So in these verses, 10 through 13, you see that Abraham has a natural fear, and he comes up with a secular solution to his fears. Verse 11. And it was just as he was coming near to enter Egypt, he said to Sarah, his wife, behold, please, I know that a woman of beautiful appearance, you are a woman of beautiful appearance. And it will be when the Egyptians see you, feminine singular, they will say, this is his wife. And they will slay me, they'll kill me, and you they will keep alive. So the fear that he has is that the Egyptian men are going to take his beautiful wife. So in the time of that this was written, this was the common thought about Egyptian men. Now, I don't know if I have any Egyptian people in my congregation or that are listening to this. I've been to Egypt several times, and one time in 1984, Sarah and I were young and she was very beautiful, and we went into Egypt and we went to Cairo, and you know, you're in Egypt, so we took camels. First time I'd ever been on a camel. I don't recommend camel rides for any reason at any time. But we took camels to go from the hotel where we were staying, which was later destroyed by terrorists, but we went from that hotel to the pyramids. And we each had our own camel, and we each had our own camel driver. And Sarah had long red hair braids, and she was wearing a pair of shorts, long shorts. And her camel driver was a scraggly-toothed Egyptian. And he kept pulling her camel and reaching up and rubbing her leg, saying, "You ask your husband for something for me. You ask your husband something for me." And it was probably about a 30-minute ride from the hotel to the pyramids. And by the time we got to the pyramids, I looked over, and Sarah had her legs completely up on the top of the camel, as high as she could possibly go. And when the camels stopped, she jumped off of that and came running over to me and told me the story. And, you know, being myself, all I could do was just laugh at the circumstances. But that was my one experience with Egyptian men and their treatment of women. So is it possible that this isn't a justified concern that Abram has, that they're going to find out he's got an absolutely breathtaking wife? And by the way, she's over 65 at this point, ladies. You know, I understand they live longer, but she was 65 when they finally left Haran, and they've been journeying south now for some time. Abram's 10 years older than she is, but she's a beautiful woman, and Abram has a fear about this. And so he says, here's how we're going to solve this problem. So, where am I? What verse? Okay, verse 13. Please now, this is his solution, please say that you are my sister. So this is, and it's an imperative, but tell them you're my sister. This is his solution. So this tells us a little bit about Abram's lineage, that little chart on that other handout. She is probably a sister to him in that they have the same father but different mothers. That's the best guess that we have. So she's a half-sister. But what's his motivation here? Please say, you are my sister, so that it will go, that it will be good for me because of you. Because of your sake, it will go well with me, and my soul will live because of you. So the solution here that he comes up with is you tell them that you're a sister, and, you know, you do that and things will go well for me. So let's go on to verse 14 and through 16 and look at what happens now because of this. So what's Abram's motivation here? Well, it looks to me like it's fear and greed. He's afraid that they're going to kill him and take his wife. And he's also hoping that it'll go well with him if she tells a half-truth. Okay? Let's look at verses 14 through 16. And it was when Avram entered Egypt, the Egyptians, so they were on the cusp of going into this foreign land, and the Egyptians saw the woman because she was very beautiful. So, you know, Abram knew what he was talking about, and the Egyptians saw. And the princes of the Pharaoh saw her, and they praised her to Pharaoh. So she was such a looker, such a beautiful woman, that the leaders saw her and went and told Pharaoh about it. And the woman was taken into the house of Pharaoh. So when they inquired, she says, Abram is my brother. And that makes her fair game. And so the leader of Egypt says, all right, put her into my harem. And for Abram, he caused good to be done on account of her. And there was to him, that is to Abram, sheep and oxen, and male donkeys, and male servants, and female servants, and female donkeys, and camels. So, you know, it worked out for Abram. He had a motivation that it would go well with me, and he's got the fear that they're going to kill him and take his wife. So his fear and greed motivated him. And the result is that he's amassing huge amounts of things. Now remember, Abram was told to go and to be a blessing, all right? But now his motivation isn't faith, and it isn't generosity, it's fear and greed. And fear and greed are powerful emotions. They're not productive, but they're very powerful. And he has this amassing now of goods, all of these things. But in verse 17, are Abram's motivations of fear and greed beneficial? Are they a blessing to other people? What do you think?
No.
Look at verse 17. And the Lord plagued Pharaoh with great plagues. So this plague, you know, we don't know the exact specifications of it, but he made them all horribly, horribly sick. Everybody in Egypt, except for Abram and his crew, Lot, Sarah, all the people with him. And the Lord plagued Pharaoh with a great, great plagues. And his house, everything attached to Pharaoh, over the matter of Sarai, Abram's wife, the wife of Abraham. So here you have judgment of God poured out upon really innocent people. It's the antithesis of being a blessing. He's become a curse to these people. Oh, Bill's back. No, it's all right. We've missed that a lot. Little background music. You can see the Egyptian ladies dancing. So let's look at this this judgment here. Now, what happens here in verses 18 through 20 is that Abram beats, he retreats. He has an ungodly retreat. And Pharaoh called to Abram and said, "What is this?" Feminine singular. What is this woman? What is this that you did to me? And for what reason did you not tell me that she is your wife? And for what reason did you say she is my sister? So, you know, what kind of an answer is Abram going to give to this? Well, because I was motivated by fear and greed. That was my motivation. I think all the Egyptian men are horrible, and you'd kill me and take my... Is he going to tell them that? Pharaoh continues, "And I took her to myself for a wife." So he actually put her in the harem to make a wife of her. And God intervened and brought everything to a complete and total standstill. So whatever this plague was, there was no procreating going on. The whole place was shut down with serious, serious illnesses that brought a stop to everything. And so how long did this go on? Probably, you know, a long time. So if you wake up with a sore throat, what do you think? Well, I probably should drink some water and eat some vitamin C. You know, and you go on with life. But then you get to work and everybody has a sore throat. And before you know it, now you're looking at a COVID plague. And everything stops. And it stopped for a long enough period of time that they started saying, this is not a normal illness. There is something seriously wrong. Plus the Hebrews, they're all incredibly healthy, and we're all sick as dogs. This isn't right. And so they figured out inductively that they're the reason we're so sick. This is like the sailors on Jonah's boat, you know. They figured out this is not a normal storm, and he's the reason we're having problems. So, you know, Pharaoh says to Abram, "What in the world are you thinking? How in the world could you do this? I took her for a wife. And so now, behold, your wife. Here's your wife, not your sister. Here's your wife. Take, go. Two imperatives. Get out of my sight. And Pharaoh commanded the men concerning him, that is Abram, and sent them away, the way this term is used in chapter 18, probably with an escort, an armed guard. We're not going to let this guy even stay in our vicinity. And sent him away, and his wife, and all the stuff that was given to him. So all of the things that are listed in verse 14 through 16, all of that, he didn't want it back. He figured out inductively that God is protecting Abraham, is working with Abraham in a way that he doesn't work with anybody else, and you better not do anything against this guy or there'll be a huge problem in your life. So all the stuff that they collected, they got carted to the border and sent home. And there's no answer. Abram has no answer whatsoever. So there's a dramatic increase here in their possessions. We saw that. You know, is it possible that this amassing of stuff and animals and people is the reason why there's no longer the opportunity for Lot and Abram to be together? That we'll see that there was so much stuff that they had to separate. Maybe this is the reason. And also, do you think Hagar was one of the people that was given to them at this time? That Hagar, the Egyptian woman, was attached to Sarah at this time. So she would have gone with them as well. So, you know, when we're told to walk in the steps of faith of Father Abraham, Romans 4, this is not that, is it? Here, he's motivated by fear and greed. And fear and greed make a terrible master. They're a terrible motivator. What God calls us to do is to walk by faith, not fear, and be generous, to be a blessing to other people. Even in the face of rising gas prices and all the rest of the things that are going on in our lives, the requirement is faith and generosity, not greed and fear. I was probably fourth grade, and my parents were very hard workers. They moved from Canada to the United States down into the deserts of Arizona. And I was actually born in 1954 in Arizona, the first of our family to be born in the States. Now there's all kinds of Effas born in the States, but my sisters were born in 49 up in BC, and 2 years later they moved down into Arizona. And my folks worked hard. My dad had eighth grade education. He worked as a laborer on a farm, and then he worked carpentry during the day, did the farm at night, hard working, and they scraped together enough money to buy a couple of lots out in the desert. There's not any electricity, there's not any water. They bought lots, and then my dad had some houses that needed to be relocated. You buy them for a song, and he moved them there, and my parents rebuilt those houses. And I remember going with my dad once a week. We'd go to a place about 5 miles away where you could take 55-gallon drums of water, fill them up with water, take them over, and pump them up to a reservoir at the top of the house. And that 55 gallons of water was what they would use, all they'd get for the next week. And these were rentals out in the desert. We got a call one time, and the rental was on fire. So we got in the car, again, the 49 Plymouth, and we drove out to the desert where our house was, had two of them, but one of them was completely engulfed, completely in flames. And it turns out that there was a volunteer fire department. I don't think my dad knew about that, but you had to pay $100 a year for the fire department to protect your property. And he hadn't paid that $100. So the fire department showed up, turned around and left. And so we stood there in front of this house, it was night already, and watched this house burn. And it was, you know, it was impressive. It was pier and beam, all wood. I mean, it went into absolute nothingness. And I remember listening to my mom and dad talk. You know, they couldn't believe it. They'd worked so hard on this property, and now it's all gone up in flames. You know, and as a lad, I watched them. I thought it was really cool. You know, wow, you know, I want to be a firefighter. You know, it's just incredibly awesome. And when it was all over, you know, I remember my dad talking to me, and we left the desert there and drove back down the mountain into Phoenix, and we went to Uptown's, which was an ice cream parlor. And we went there and we had Splits ice cream sundaes, which we never, ever, ever got because we were poor. But my dad stopped us and said, it all belongs to the Lord. Amen. And this is to remind us that God owns everything.
That's right.
All these years later, I still remember that ice cream. It had cherry on top. It had whipped cream. I mean, it had a little cool cut glass. It was awesome. We never had anything like that. Faith. Generosity. That's how you be a blessing to other people.